So let's start the show off with some rapid-fire local headlines.
Congressmember Paul Tonko is touring four local water systems this week as part of his push for the Drinking Water System Improvement Act of 2017, which would provide billions of dollars for drinking water systems across the country. On Monday, Tonko toured the Rotterdam Water Pumping Station in Schenectady, where the town has requested $5 million in order to construct a new storage tank, upgrade wells, and distribution systems.
The Albany Times Union editorialized this week against the proposal by Governor Cuomo to change the way the state makes payments to local governments for state forest preserves in the Adirondack and Catskills. Under present law, the state the local government assesses the value of the preserves in the same way they do for private property in order to determine the tax payments by the state. The governor, facing a $4 billion state budget deficit, just wants the state to determine how much payments it will make to the local governments, including a 2% cap on any increase in payments.
On Tuesday, February 27th, from 6 to 8 p.m., the Albany County Sheriff will hold a forum in the Watervliet High School auditorium about the nationwide heroin and opioid epidemic. Sheriff Apple, along with officials from the Addiction Center, CFS, Catholic Charities, Hope House, and Albany Medical Center, will also talk about where heroin overdoses are now occurring, prevention tips, how addiction starts, and how to get help.
A New York State Department of Health study showed that three sexually transmitted diseases, including HIV, increased faster in the Capital District in the last 2 years than in any other place in the state. The number of new HIV cases doubled in Schenectady County in 2015-16. Fortunately, while the percentages are high, the number of cases were relatively small other than for gonorrhea, which saw 450 cases in Albany County and 169 in Rensselaer County.
A week after a gunman killed 17 people at a Florida high school, students who survived the attack are bringing their hashtag Never Again protest movement to the Florida State Capitol to demand action on guns and mental health. The shooting has galvanized students at the high school who have begun to turn their grief into a call for action. Florida legislators, however, remain opposed to one of the key demands, the banning of assault-type weapons. Meanwhile, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected a challenge to California's 10-day waiting period for firearms purchases that is intended to guard against impulsive violence and suicides.
A new study by the American Civil Liberties Union found that judges in 26 states and Puerto Rico had issued arrest warrants for alleged debtors at the request of private debt collectors. This practice violates many state and federal laws that prohibit the jailing of debtors. The study found numerous ways that courts help the private debt collectors extract payments, even when there is no evidence that debt is owed or when the person isn't legally required to pay. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
WOOC caught up with the executive director of the Fiscal Policy Institute at the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus conference last weekend to talk about President Trump's federal budget proposals. We're talking with Ron Deutsch, the executive director of the Fiscal Policy Institute. Recently, the president put out his new federal budget. Ron, how does New York fare in this budget that the Trump administration is pushing?
I don't think New York is going to fare particularly well, and I think we need to think about a few things here. The reality is that New York is pretty reliant on federal funding for many of the programs and services that we administer. About 36% of our all-funds budget comes from the federal government, so that's more than the 30% that comes from our personal income tax in New York. So, yes, we are reliant on federal funding. I'd say the largest amounts, about $37 billion, go toward Medicaid. another $3.78 billion go towards the Essential Plan, which was the Medicaid expansion plan that was put in place under the Affordable Care Act. So a lot of people are relying on federal dollars for their health care, for sure. But then we also get, you know, billions more. We get up to about $57 billion in our all funds budget that goes to everything from social service programs to housing programs to public protection. There's a wide list of things that it goes to. And then outside of the state, we also have local governments who are dependent on federal funds. We have school districts. Our housing authorities in particular are very dependent on federal funds. For instance, New York City Housing Authority, 60% of its funding comes from the Fed. So, yes, we're very concerned about what the president is proposing right now. Whether or not it's going to move forward remains to be seen. But I think there's great cause for concern given the amount of cuts that he's looking at making.
Now, the governor has his own budget out, sort of some hocus pocus on how he's going to try to deal with the $4 billion or more revenue gap. How does the Trump new budget proposal complicate the state budget negotiations?
Well, let's remember, it was just a few short weeks ago that Congress really came to an agreement on a spending package that the governor, that the president signed into law. So this spending package actually increases spending in some areas. But what the president does is basically throw that to the wind and attempts to make, you know, billions and billions, hundreds of billions of dollars in cuts in many, many programs across the board, everything ranging from Medicaid to Social Security disability insurance to housing programs to food assistance. He's really kind of targeting low-income, needy, vulnerable populations throughout this country. And I think it's, you know, unconscionable that he's doing this. And the reality is, you know, why is he doing this? Well, you know, he just also signed into law a federal tax bill that they all take great pride in, whereas 80% of those benefits over the 10-year period go to the top 1% of Americans. And it basically mushrooms our deficit by about $1.5 trillion over the next 10 years. So now these deficit hawks who just increased the deficit are looking to basically, you know, cut the deficit on the backs of poor people. And I think that's just horrible.
Now, over the years, of course, we've seen Republicans in Congress try to do a lot of cuts to the food stamp program, and even in New York City, they try to limit the food stamp program to get rid of certain items like soda and stuff. Have some of those longtime Republican attacks on the food stamp program resurfaced?
Oh, absolutely. I think the president is really looking to really decimate the food stamp program. He's looking to cut it by more than $213 billion over the next 10 years, or nearly 30%. So it's going to reduce the amount of food stamp benefits going to individuals. It's going to put a variety of different limitations on it. And now he's gone as far as to suggest that the government will send you a box of non-perishable food, basically instead of giving you your entire food stamp budget. So instead of people being allowed to go to the stores and shop at local supermarkets, which, you know, is good for the economy, we're going to be getting, you know, this kind of blue apron approach, if you will. I'm sure people would wish it was more like blue apron, but the reality is it's going to be, you know, we're going back to the kind of government cheese days where you'll get a box of food from the government, and hopefully that'll tide you over. But the reality is this is a sad mistake, and I'm hoping we'll never move forward.
Well, you mentioned previously the federal budget cuts in Medicaid. Healthcare is the biggest part, I believe, of the state budget. How is New York impacted by the federal budget cuts on the healthcare front?
Yeah, obviously whatever happens on Medicaid is going to be damaging to New York, especially if there are cuts made. So the president is proposing a number of things. He's proposing to block grant Medicaid to states and put a per capita income limit on or per capita limit on the amount of spending per person. So regardless of how much assistance you need, you know, you're going to be limited to a certain cap on assistance. So if you're, you know, very sick or you're in nursing homes or things like that, this is going to create problems. And then the other reality is You know, block granting is basically a euphemism for cutting funding, and that's exactly what they're doing under the kind of the guise of providing more flexibility at the state level. But this could blow billions of dollars in holes in our state budget at a time when we're already facing a $4.4 billion gap that we're trying to close this year alone. So the state actually, in last year's budget, put a plan in place. So basically, if the cuts to Medicaid and or other federal programs exceed $850 million to the state, what's going to happen is the Division of Budget will put out a plan, a remediation plan, if you will, on how to make up for those cuts. And the legislature then will have either 90 days to act on that plan or come up with their own plan. So, you know, we would want to make sure we're working with the legislature to come up with a plan that makes sense and that actually raises revenue to fill those gaps rather than cutting more programs and services to poor people.
Now, some people have said that the president's budget proposals are dead on arrival, particularly because just a few weeks ago, the Congress cut a deal on the federal budget. You know, what are the politics and what are the dynamics of this budget debate that we're likely to see in the next few months at the federal level?
You know, so I don't know that anything the president necessarily puts forward is dead on arrival. He seems to have a knack at trying to get things to move through and pushing people to do what he wants. I mean, granted, we were able to beat back the repeal of the Affordable Care Act to a certain degree, but obviously in the tax bill, they eliminated the individual mandate, so that kind of eviscerated part of the Affordable Care Act. But, you know, the reality is we have a 2018 midterm election coming up, and many members of Congress, particularly New York members, you know, have to run on this notion of cutting programs and services to many of their constituents. I mean, think about the fact that almost one in three New Yorkers is receiving Medicaid assistance of some sort. One in six New Yorkers or so are receiving food stamps, you know, and they're looking at making these major cuts to these programs that serve a lot of their constituents. So I don't think that Congress is going to have an appetite for what the president's proposing right now. My sense is what we're going to see this year is things that Republicans and the GOP in Congress feel resonate well with their base and resonate well with independents. So I think what we're going to see is a lot of talk about work requirements or work opportunities for people who are on public assistance or receiving food stamps and or Medicaid. You know, we already have work requirements in place really across the board for many programs, but I think what they want to do is make these even more stringent and require more work out of people, which, you know, I think is really more kind of busy work than anything else at times. So the reality is that, you know, they want to impose new work requirements and you know, make it even more difficult for people to receive assistance. So I think that's the direction we're going to see them moving in this year. But who knows what happens after that.
So we have a little bit less than a minute left. We've been talking to Ron Deuce, Executive Director of Fiscal Policy Institute. Ron, if people want to follow, you know, what's going on with the federal budget, how best to do that?
So I think you can check out a number of different websites. Our allies in Washington are the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. Their website is cbpp.org, and you can check out our website at fiscalpolicy.org. There's a lot of information right now up there about the state budget, and we're also putting up this week some congressional district fact sheets that really kind of walk people through the number of people receiving assistance in each congressional district. So our members of Congress will have some idea of who they're going to be impacting.
Thank you, Ron Deutsch.
Where are we?
So that was myself, WOC correspondent Mark Dunley, and I was interviewing Ron Deutsch of the Fiscal Policy Institute about the federal budget. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM.
In our next segment, we are joined by John Amidon in our weekly Peace Bucket. He is the current president of Veterans for Peace, Albany chapter, a longtime attender of Albany Friends Meeting, and a member and past president of the Interfaith Alliance of New York State. Today, we will be speaking with John about the connection between veterans and mass shootings in America. John, thank you for joining us tonight.
Oh, my pleasure.
John, which branch of the military did you serve in?
I served in the Marine Corps. I was in the Marine Corps from 1965 to the end of 1968, 4 years. I was very fortunate. I didn't go to Vietnam. My orders sent me to Okinawa, so I spent a year overseas there. But I was blessed with the good luck of not going to Vietnam.
Can you tell us a little bit about your weapons training?
Yeah, there was quite a bit of weapons training at boot camp. We used the M14 rifle. We hadn't quite transitioned yet to the M16 in the Marine Corps. And it was very important to qualify. There were three categories of qualification: marksmanship, sharpshooter, and expert. And the reason, you know, it's important to mention the M16 is because the recent shooting and many of the mass shootings in America are with the AR-15, and the NRA has called the AR-15 the civilian version of the M16, which was decidedly a combat weapon. And so when we're focusing in on veterans and their connections with mass shootings, one of the reasons would be that many of them have training and have used the M16 and would be then very familiar with the use of the AR-15.
Well, I have seen recently that mass shooters in the U.S. have been disproportionately veterans. Why is that, and what steps, if any, has the Pentagon taken to address the problem?
Well, normally it's not even identified that mass shooters are veterans. Much like the suicide epidemic was uncovered by one of the news networks, the government doesn't want you to know how badly veterans fare. I think any given night, 30% of the homeless people, for example, are veterans. And are we getting medical care? There are 49,000 vacant slots in the VA healthcare system right now. So veterans aren't treated well in general. But in terms of the mass shootings, first of all, 98% of mass shootings are done by men. And there are considerably more male veterans than women. And then secondly, veteran population, 35% of the mass shooters are military veterans as compared with 14.76% of the general civilian population. And the research I'm quoting has been done by David Swanson, and he is quite a brilliant young man who works for peace and has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. Does good work, really terrific work.
So the young shooter, you know, last week in Florida, had been trained as part of his junior ROTC program on how to handle and shoot guns. And do you have any thoughts about how such programs, you know, training, you know, students in the schools to, you know, shoot and use and be, you know, around guns? How do you think that has contributed to the problems of guns and gun violence in the United States?
Well, our public education is a mechanism for militarizing the young people. For example, when I went for public schools, American history timeline started with the Revolutionary War when I was there, and then it goes to the War of 1812, jumps to the Civil War. We did a little bit on the wars and, you know, of the conquest over the American Indians, Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II, Korean War. The Vietnam War hadn't happened yet. So I'm a kid, and I'm being taught all of my life that the really interesting and valiant and brave and bold parts of American histories are war, war, and war, and pretty much nothing happened in between. So I'm waiting for my war when I get out of high school. And believe me, the system has a war waiting for you, because it is a mechanism for transferring wealth from poor and middle class to the rich. And Smedley Butler, commandant of the Marine Corps, wrote about it a long time ago. War is a racket. It's a very famous speech and pamphlet. So So our educational system, part of its mission is to militarize youth. And of course, in many, many schools today, we have JROTC, which is the Junior Reserve Officer Training Program. And this young man, Nicholas Cruz, was a member of JROTC while down in Florida. And so I'm sure he was thoroughly militarized, in even more so than I was.
Do you consider mass shootings an unintended consequence of war and militarism?
Yeah, absolutely, because we have all these veterans who, you know, aren't being cared for, aren't in the best of health. And, when we talk about mass shooters, there are obviously a lot of factors that goes into being a mass shooter. Mental health is clearly an issue, domestic violence, the media, income equality, gender, and many other factors. So it's not only being a veteran, but when you add the military training and the abuse that the military dishes out on the enlisted man, and many officers for that matter too, then you have a combination of factors. And if you have been in combat, then there's a good chance that you've already killed. So you're taught you can solve your problems by killing people. That is part of the American system of education. And we cannot solve our problems by killing each other.
Now, John, you mentioned earlier that, war is a mechanism to make the wealthier. And, of course, it always stuns me that, 53% or so of the federal budget technically non-discretionary spending, goes to the military. I think some people would say it's actually, higher than that when you count in all the debt. And that one of the big fights in this recent budget showdown on the federal government was, we weren't spending enough on the military. But, maybe could you elaborate a little bit for people, how does war make the rich even richer?
Well, we are the greatest weapons seller in the world. We supply weapons to everybody. In fact, most of our enemies who are shooting at us are using American-made weapons. When it comes to selling weapons, we sell. And, when some of the countries and proxy armies we supply weapons lose, then our enemies gain control of the weapons, much like they did in Iraq. I mean, ISIS, for example, is using American weapons. And so the sale of weapons is just a huge part of the economy, and that's one of the major factors in that transference of wealth.
Hmm. To be honest, one thing that sort of surprised me a bit is how strong the military has been over the years on anti-hunger programs, because they want to make sure that young men are fed better so that when they get to be 18, 19, 20, they can go out and fight wars. But I know another issue of the militarization of the population has been the issue of, more and more excess military hardware and training and tactics being provided to the local police departments.
You're absolutely right.
And I just wonder if you have any observations about that.
Well, with the militarization of the police department, then the police department doesn't actually view the civilian population as somebody they're there to protect and serve. They start viewing them as the enemy, and they start treating them as the entity, and they have military weapons, and then they start using them. And we've seen quite a few police shootings every year. So it is dangerous to all of us. When war is normalized to the degree and extent it has, it creates this great income inequality. It makes a lot of people poor, and it creates a propensity towards violence because the whole population is in generally taught that killing is a way, violence is a way to solve your problems. So in the case of all of the shootings, I mean, there were a number of shootings that were done with AR-15s too. There's another example. When you develop military-style weapons, and the M16 AR-15 civilian equivalent wasn't a hunting rifle, never was. It was made for killing people. It fires, if you're skilled with it, 85 rounds per second. You have to, technically it would fire more, but you have 30 round clips in your magazines. You have to change your magazine. You have to refocus. So somebody who is proficient with an AR-15 would probably get off 85, 90 rounds a minute. I think I said second before, but I meant minute. And so, you know, I come from a hunting culture. My parents were from Gloversville, my father and grandfather. Everybody hunts, you know, that I knew up there. Nobody's out there with an AR-15. Give me a break, you know.
So we probably have about 4 minutes left. So I wanted to ask you a somewhat different question. You know, earlier in the Trump administration, there was a lot of controversy over the president's reaction or lack of reaction when these four soldiers were killed in Niger. And, you know, one of the things people ask, well, why are we there in Niger to begin? Where is Niger? And it turned out one of the things they were doing there was they were locating the drone command center for Africa into Niger, and that's one of the reasons we had troops there. But I know you've been fairly active around the drones issue here in New York State and out at the Hancock Air Force Base. Might even gotten trouble once or twice out there. Can you maybe just bring us a little bit up to speed where we are with the drones issue here in New York?
Well, unfortunately, drones are proliferating. There's a base now up at Niagara and Watertown. The drones are flying over a good part of New York State. They've been cleared. I'm not sure of, you know, the extent, but I think it's approximately 3/5 of New York State. They've been cleared to fly. They've been doing training missions over the Adirondacks for years now. The anti-drone resistance movement, which I'm part of up there, we had a number of arrests last year. We had the Nativity Scene action, the Good Friday action, and then we had an action called the Dollar Sign action, or it was based on Rich Man's Wars, Poor Man's Blood. And all of the cases actually have been recently dismissed. We've been doing very well in court. We've got some really terrific lawyers, and I think we are winning hearts and minds very slowly with our persistence. I think that people are becoming more and more aware of how deadly and how misguided and inaccurate the killing of poor and people of color worldwide by the Air Force, but specifically in this case with the use of drones, is not in the interest of anybody. And I think with more and more media exposure and more of the really tragic events of murdering wedding parties and funeral processions and village meetings, and the incident in Niger's when the facts came out wasn't at all what they portrayed it to be, people are waking up, and even we hope the courts are waking up. So we have been getting some dismissals, and when we have had jury trials, we've also been acquitted, which has been great. They have, you know, the judges up there have been allowing us to use the laws that we wish to use, the U.S. Constitution, the Supremacy Clause in it, which obligates us to our treaties, follow our treaties. And anyway, when the jury actually gets to hear our legal defense, they often agree with it.
John, you've piqued a lot of interest, and if people want to know more about Veterans for Peace, what's the best way for them to do so?
The best way is to go to our national website, veteransforpeace.org, and there's a tremendous amount of information there. You don't have to be a veteran to join Veterans for Peace also. Mostly we are veterans, but if you're interested in our organization and not a veteran, you're welcome to join as an associate member.
Well, thank you. Thank you, John Amidon. And every Wednesday, we will have a segment on the local peace community.
For those just tuning in, I'm J.P. Pogorski.
And I'm Mark Dunley. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOC 105.3 FM Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org.
Next, some of our College City growers, Azaray Christian and Baby Ember, visited the mecca of compost facilities in Montpelier, Vermont. Listen up as they learn about the art of building fertility and how our livelihood depends on soil health.
I'm Carl Hammer, and this is the Vermont Compost Company.
Can you tell us why you think that building soil is important?
I believe there is but one soil. It includes the ocean, the land, and the sky. And we are walking, talking part of it. And that's not a metaphor. That's a concise biophysics description of our status. We are walking soil. And we emerge pretty recently from soil. So soil process in terms of plant and microbe goes back about 500 million years. And we step out and start talking less than 2 million years ago. And we are a tiny portion of the whole biomass of soil. The soil is all in motion, always, even though it feels, you know, terra firma isn't very. Even the best of soil is only half solid, and the other half is a changing ratio of gas and liquid fractions. And erosion is a constant. The mountains erode to the sea. And then there are eruptions that material again. So why is it important to build soil? We are totally dependent on the soil function for our existence as a species and for our continuation. And we've been warned about neglecting soil many times in many places. Last year, Vandana Shiva came and talked to a conference we were having in February in Burlington, again this weekend. And she quoted a Vedic proverb from 5,500 years ago, and it goes something like this. This handful of soil, husband it, and it will feed you, it will clothe you, shelter you, and surround you with beauty. Abuse it, it will collapse and die, taking humanity with it.
Seems to make pretty good sense.
Yeah, so that's journalism from 5,500 years ago. This was something that had been observed, said with the fewest, with tremendous economy of word, no extra words in there.
Are you surprised by the amount of available nutrient in the waste stream currently? And have you seen it increase over the years?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm surprised. I've been in the rescuing squandered resources business for more than 40 years now. It does surprise me how long it's taken. You know, I used to think it was so obvious that we had to be on this, and that we should separate the foul from the fair, and where, you know, and use biological process to sweeten the rotten and all of that. And once you start, I mean, I was enthralled with manure when I was quite young. It interested me enormously. I was entranced by its perfumes and flavors. So if I'm surprised by anything, it's how long it's taken. You know, suddenly all over the country, wow, the food, wasting food, is an issue, as well it should be, and I salute it. You know, waste is a verb, not a noun. It's a set of decisions we make to waste things. Has it increased? We're still, in the United States, landfilling most of the resource. Frankly, you know, we've been talking about it hard for the last 30 years. It's been a known thing that we must do differently. So in Vermont, we're actually doing a bit better than that, I think. Mm-hmm. We have a mandate. We have a robust industry of reclaiming these resources. I say robust. Profitability is still elusive for a lot of composting ventures. Our enterprise sometimes gets looked at and say, oh, well, they look like they might be making money, and we are making money. But we're a kind of high-tech export business. sort of masquerading as a commodity business, and it's value-added product that makes us profitable. If it was just compost for local use, we probably couldn't keep doing it. Certainly not paying wages that would be in any way competitive with other industries. Ultimately for stability, we need to have this be a professional craft. Mm-hmm. It certainly demands a level of skill and competence that we don't want a new potting soil mixer every 2 weeks. We want people that have learned to do it and do it well and do it, replicate. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, more so than I expected. Do you think this type of system can be scaled down to, say, yard-sized?
Yes, absolutely. And, there's some guys in Cleveland, the Rust Riders, they call themselves. You know about those guys?
No.
Yeah, they do it all with bicycles, and they got a... I talked to them about the economics of what they're trying to do. They now have some investors who are looking to see some sales, which can be challenging. But yeah, it can be scaled. It lends itself to relatively small scale, but not that's hard to get profitability. That's the story of our times. We could go down and talk about scale. I mean,
what about using chickens as composting machines in your yard and not feeding them grain? Is that
we've been producing eggs for sale here every day of every year since 98. We've produced eggs for sale in this farm. We have bought no grain. So it would be foolhardy to deprive yourself of that food stream and the benefit of the chicken excreta to the process, and the benefit of the process to stabilizing the proteins in the chicken excreta, and that benefit, of course, also eliminates the malodors. So, by stacking those processes, and we deeply believe in diversity of manures, diversity of feedstocks generally, but manurial diversity. Each manure brings its own particular set of biota, and that's why when I see, we have a lot of wild turkeys here, probably 80 that are here regularly. We have the crows, we have the ravens, and we welcome each of their contributions to the diversity of our pile. We're in a, something about composting terrifies a lot of our fellow Americans. They reminds them of dying somehow. I've thought a lot about this because we're folks who are into disinfecting, very fearful about throwing ourselves on the mercy of diverse microbial ecologies, which is actually the safest place, is to be amongst crowds of your friends. By the fields and forests surrounding, and the chickens are actually, I believe, important in vectors of beneficials from the, because our birds are not, first of all, our birds are free to leave here. There's no fence that keeps them here. Okay, so we say free to leave. What does that mean for a chicken? Well, that could be homeless. So welcome to stay where she wants to be is a high aspiration for chicken, and not just chicken. Welcome to stay where you want to be. I can't imagine any small scale conversion of these resources that would deny chickens a place in it. It doesn't make any sense. Why? I mean, get eggs, you get food that first day right away. The compost, you have to make the compost and grow something in it. And that's, so compost is near to being food, but I realize in those 20 years that we've been producing eggs here, I personally have probably eaten 20,000 eggs.
That was an interview with Carl Hammer, president and founder of Vermont Compost Company. If you'd like to learn more about what it takes to craft healthy living systems, tune in to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine to explore how we, as productive citizens, can contribute to a more sustainable future.
And coming up next, we hear from the Delmar Sharpener, a.k.a. Chaz Martell, about his local knife sharpening business. Segment, we're speaking with Chaz Martell. He's known as the Delmar Sharpener because his business is primarily in Delmar, but it also involves sharpening knives, scissors, and garden tools. Chaz, tell us what got you started in the business, and because I thought it was long since dead, that kind of skill.
Well, when I was a little boy, I used to use the back of my mother's electric can opener to sharpen knives, and I loved the sparks. When I was thinking about becoming a knife sharpener, I had an opportunity as well to partner with the Delmar Dog Butler. So I talked to my daughter, who was in her teens at that time, going to high school, what she would prefer to be able to introduce her father as, either the Delmar Dog Butler or the Delmar Sharpener, and she made the decision. So I decided to become a sharpening person, a cutler.
So if somebody's looking to purchase a knife, what are some of the qualities they should be looking for?
I think that it's very important to consider balance and heft. A knife that is too light forces you as a user to put a lot more pressure behind the blade in order to pass through product. Also, if it's sharp, it usually passes through product very easily. So it's important that it be a good quality steel. But if you don't have the money to, say, spend $100, $150 on a chef's knife, then you can get yourself a $30 or $40 one and still have it maintained by someone like me. And it'll still work. It just won't hold its edge as long, and it won't hone as easily as a more expensive knife.
And how many knives does someone really need?
All you really need is an 8 to 10-inch chef's knife and a paring knife. Those are the essentials. Now, if you want to add something, if you like to cut meat away from bone, a boning knife is helpful. If you like to fillet fish, there are specialty knives for filleting fish. They're very flexible and long. And then if you want, a slicer is also a good thing to have for when you're carving a roast or something. Serrated bread knives, if you have a sharp knife, you don't need one, and you actually create less crumb when you slice bread with a straight edge knife than a serrated knife.
And a good chef's knife is about $150, you said?
You're going to spend at least $100 for it, and you can spend as much as $1,000 if you want to, but that's ridiculous.
And the paring knife would be?
Paring knife is usually a good one, and I don't think I should be mentioning any other names, but it's going to run about $30, $40.
So altogether, $200 or so is a good investment in all the knives that are necessary.
Yeah, and occasionally some of the stores, like this last season before Christmas, I mentioned that there was I saw an ad in one of those circulars I got in the mail that had a blue cover on it, and I called my friend who I knew had bad knives, wanted to get new knives for his wife. I said, hey, they're selling a $250 set of knives for $150 for Christmas. I think that's what you need to get your wife. And that's not a bad deal. That's not a bad set of knives. It's just that's not the ideal. When you're buying a knife, it really is a lifetime investment. So you can afford, from an amortization standpoint, to go with something a little bit pricey at the beginning.
So I'm going to admit not to be an expert about knives. So, you know, I've been probably for 10 or 15 years cutting the vegetables with the same knife, and then, you know, occasionally maybe some fish or some chicken. How does one know when it's time to get your knife sharpened?
I have a very practical test about that. I tell people, take a fist-sized onion, slice it as thinly as you can. If you're crying in the end, you should have your knife sharpened, because from a practical standpoint, we all should be able to slice through one onion without crying.
And what is the general cost of sharpening these knives?
I sharpen knives for $3 to $6 a knife, depending on how long it is. If it's extremely dull or damaged, it's a little extra, but it's always reasonable, and my clientele is very happy.
Okay, so how long would these people, say you bought a $150 knife and you use it every day, when would they come, how long would it take before they have to come to you and spend $5?
Well, part of that has to do with whether or not they use the honing steel to maintain the edge, because I sharpen, which means I create a bevel on the knife. A honing steel is a device that looks like a metal rod, and it should be at least as long as your longest knife. And you swipe the knife on alternating sides, and that straightens out the bevel, because time and use causes the bevel to shift, and it doesn't shift regularly or dependably in one way or the other. So you have to do it on both sides to straighten out the edge, and then you have optimal cutting situation.
Now, are there, you know, a lot of knife sharpeners these days, you know, as a profession? Do people, you know enough these days to get their knives sharpened?
Well, I have, there is a guild of knife sharpeners in New York City, and they basically have territories, and that's the agreement through the guild. Up here, the closest knife sharpener that I know of, who's full-time professional as I am, is Mr. Edge in Glens Falls. I don't know of any others.
Okay, I understand straight edges and there's serrated edges. What are the advantages of a straight edge over a serrated edge?
Well, straight edges are much easier to maintain, and I can sharpen them much more inexpensively than I can a serrated edge. And some serrations are not sharpenable at all. For example, a micro-serrated blade is not sharpenable at all. When that knife gets dull, you just wrap it up in newspaper and toss it in the garbage.
So are ceramic knives good for anything?
I own one, and there is a use for a ceramic knife, because when you chiffonade basil with a steel knife, it turns the edges of the basil black. In order to avoid that, I use a ceramic knife, and I use it only for that, so I don't ever have to worry about it getting dull. And when ceramic knives get dull, you have to throw them away.
So somebody's getting married, and you're looking for a wedding gift. What do you consider, say, if you want to give them a knife for the wedding gift?
I would say give them at least a starter set, which would be something that you can purchase at some stores. And I have a particular manufacturer in mind. They come from Germany. And any knife with that particular brand is good at any price point. But I would start off a couple that's getting married with a set of a paring knife and a matching chef's knife. Usually it's an 8-inch chef's knife.
Okay. Could you give us some information about, well, you know, the thing is, you talked about your childhood experiences and things like that. Could you expound on some of that?
Well, I first started sharpening knives, as I said earlier, with the back of my mother's electric can opener. Some people might remember that type of a scenario. Then I learned how to sharpen a knife with a bench stone as a Boy Scout, following the instructions in the Boy Scout handbook. And I started looking at sharpening knives as my second marriage was beginning to come to an end.
Well, we want to thank you for joining us today. If people are looking for a knife sharpener other than yourself, I mean, how do they find it? Or
I'm at the Niskayuna Co-op every Tuesday all year long from 2 to 7 p.m. During the summer months, or I should say the good weather, I plan on being at Honest Weight this summer from 2 to 6:30 on either Wednesdays or Thursdays. I haven't decided yet because I'm trying to get into another farmer's market. And then I also sharpen a lot of knives every day, every Saturday morning at the Delmar Farmer's Market.
And if somebody wants to get a hold of you directly, do you want to give out your email?
Yeah, my email address is delmarsharpener, all one word, at AOL for AmericaOnline.com. Yes, that does date me a little bit. So that's Delmarsharpener at AOL.com. And my phone number, is it okay for me to give it out, is 518-221-5697.
Thank you, Chaz. And much happy sharpening.
Thank you. I like making people happy.
So that was Chaz Martell, the Delmar sharpener.
WOOC correspondent Melissa Bromley visited 100.9 WXIR, an independent radio station in Rochester. The radio station's program director, Rashida Ayana, spoke with Melissa about the station's programs, hosts, and the impact of the Rochester community.
So I was trained as a performer, and I met my current boss, Carvin Eisen, who's our general manager, because I was hired to act in a PSA that he was writing and directing for an organization here, a nonprofit. After that, they were in need of an office manager. I was hired as an office manager. I didn't have full-time work. I was really performing full-time and decided, sure, I'll, you know, try to get some steady income. And so I became the office manager here at RCTV first. From there, I learned, I took all of the classes while I was here. I was tasked with producing shows for the station, which grew, and then ended up teaching as well, teaching some of the classes and the summer camps and things for our youth. And then because I also have a background, I studied music business in college. That's what my major was. As we were working towards getting the radio station, I had a lot of the knowledge already that we needed in terms of how to operate or how to run the station. I just didn't really know it until I started to do it. So I ended up kind of, that ended up being my current position, you know, as the program director for the radio station. But I started as a performer.
And how long have you been here within the RCTV network?
So I've been here for 5 years, actually. So it hasn't been very long. We were talking about that in our staff meeting recently, and my boss was like, how long have you been working here now? I was like, it's been almost 5 years. It's like, it seems like so much longer. So it's just been 5 years.
For him, it's hard to imagine the time before you were here.
Yeah. And I think it's the case for me, too. You know, even though I definitely remember working other places, like I still feel like I've been doing this for much longer. Yeah.
And so how long has WXIR been on the air?
So WXIR has been on the air for a little over a year and a half. We're approaching our 2-year anniversary in May. Yeah, so it's quickly approaching, actually, now that I say it out loud.
So, I mean, that is both a long time and a very short time.
Yeah.
What have you learned in that time period that you can share with us?
I'd say the first thing that I learned is it's important to understand what your voice is and the message that you are, your overall message that you're sending to the community. That's the first thing, because without that, you can very easily get ignored. People won't know to tune to you, or if they tune to you, they don't know that they have tuned to you because they always get something different. But that also depends on the community that you're in, you know, whether or not that's a value. So I think that that's the most important thing that I've learned. In addition to that, I think being incredibly organized is really important as well. For me, I have to juggle quite a bit with the radio station. So I'm the one handling all of the reporting, you know, I deal with a lot of the accounting, managing the DJs, you know, the programming, creating the programming and getting it on the air, and even some of the technical things. I try to stay away from as much of the technical as I possibly can, though. But organization is super important. Mm-hmm.
And so how did WXIR find its voice?
We listened to our community. For a while, we were trying to fill in all of the gaps that existed in radio. And that's a bit much to do for one station, you know, but the one gap that seemed to have the largest demand for being filled is an alternative to the urban sounds that are on the airways. So the community that directly surrounds where we're physically located was looking for something else to hear. And so that's who we decided to focus on.
Do you mean like a non-commercial commercial alternative?
Yeah, so non-commercial alternatives to things. So we have some very well-established commercial stations, urban stations that focus on hip-hop, R&B, some oldies, that kind of stuff. However, there's a huge amount of independent artists and local artists who are not getting any radio play at all. And so we play as much local artists' music as we possibly can. And we also focus on independent artists that are not getting huge commercial backing from the other stations. So that's what we push for.
So you guys have done a lot in the last 2 years, mm-hmm. and I know you're still growing. What are you looking forward to in the next year?
I'm looking forward to our continued growth. because we're still growing, you know, that's really all I see right now. You know, I can't say that I see a goal line, so to speak. You know, I just see us to continue to grow and have a number of different personalities and sounds and messages that we're sending out that will enrich our community, be a value to them, definitely empower our community. I think that's really important. And so, yeah, that's what we're going to continue to focus on.
For folks in Troy who can't tune in to you guys on the FM radio, of course, they can stream it online. Can you give us an idea of what kinds of programming has come to WXIR and if there's like one or two really hit shows or something that we can learn from?
Yeah. So we've got, when tuning to us, you could hear things like jazz music. You can hear definitely R&B, hip hop, but not your big mainstream artists. You'll also hear comedy. We've got a number of comedians actually who host shows. We have our first daily show starting on Monday, which I'm really excited about, and it's hosted by a comedian, and he's gonna play, you know, some music, but I think it's gonna be really energetic and fun as well. So I would say some of the real standout shows, there's one called Tickle Me Too Tuesdays, which is on Tuesday nights, and it's hosted by several comedians, actually. It's a group of them, and they talk to people locally, business owners. They also speak to just other performers, those types of things. It's mostly entertainment, but they're also providing some really valuable information to our community as well, and to the community of Troy also. And so you can listen to us through our website, which is 1009wxir.com. We can also be listened to on the TuneIn app as well. And then we've also got some really cool music shows. Like, I don't want to say my favorite, but one of the ones I really like is a reggae show, actually, that also comes on Tuesdays right before Tickle Me Tuesday. So Tuesday night's a really, really good night. It's a fun night. And so is Wednesday. Wednesday, we've got some newer folks who've started on, but they've got so much energy that they've been bringing, and they focused more on some like R&B music. And then you'll hear a lot from our youth on Thursday nights as well. That was a lot. But those are definitely some things that I think that people would enjoy. Yeah.
Is there anything else before we let you go that you think is important for the Troy community or WOOC's community to know?
I would say be involved in the media that you are consuming as much as possible. I think that's really, really important. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be a producer or talent or host, but there's ways that you can help your local media center, whatever that may be, to thrive and to continue to be an asset to your community.
So that was Rashida Ayana, Program Director at 100.9 WXIR in Rochester, speaking with our news correspondent, Melissa Bromley. And that concludes our show. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Mark Dunlight.
And I'm J.P. Pogorski. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page.
As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at the Sanctuary at 7:07 p.m., held right after the show. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.